faster than an airplane, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. He is Superman. Superman was the first superhero that I remember as a kid. Christopher Reeves, the mild-mannered journalist, turns in to this, the all-powerful Superman. He didn't quite look like that, but that's who Superman looks like to me. All-powerful, could do anything, except there was one thing that could render Superman powerless. You know what it was? Lois Lane. Yeah, a woman. No, you got it right. It was kryptonite, which I always found ironic because he came from the planet Krypton. But kryptonite had the power to render Superman powerless. But he still was a hero, which is what we've been talking about over the last 3 weeks. I'm so glad that you're here. My name is Evan. I'm one of the pastors on staff. You're over in the West. You're joining us at North Point Live. Welcome. Week one, we said that a hero sees what everyone else sees, but a hero is not content to do what everyone else does. And then last week, we said that a hero saves the day, which if Superman was your picture of a hero or Wonder Woman, that seems like a lofty and unattainable goal. But Andy retold the story of the Good Samaritan, and in that, Jesus made hero status accessible for us all. So if a hero sees what everyone else sees, but takes action and saves the day, what is keeping you and what is keeping me from being the hero that we're called to be? What is the kryptonite that has the power to render us powerless? I want to talk about that today because it is the kryptonite that has rendered me powerless through the years that I've wrestled with for most of my adult life. And is the kryptonite, I wonder if potentially we all wrestle with from time to time. But before we do that, I want to tell you a quick story. 1986, this is a picture of my hero. This is Gary Carter. Gary was the catcher for the 1986 World Series Championship Mets. He is a Hall of Famer. He was the glue for the team. The team captain had a fantastic year. And that year, I was 12 years old and also a catcher. So when I was 12, I thought, I'm going to be the next Gary Carter. Now, here is a picture of me in 1986. I did not play for the World Championship 1986 World Series Mets. I played for the Carolina Power and Light Kilowatts. And we were awesome. This was the second year that I played for the team, and this was the last year I played for the team. I'd be graduating out of this league. And back in 1986, not everyone got a trophy. There were only a few trophies that were handed out. What is that? It's true. You know this. And there was one trophy that was the most coveted trophy of all. It was the most valuable player trophy. And I had decided in early 1986 that I was going to win the most valuable player trophy. And so we had a good year. I practiced, worked hard. And we came to the end of the season, and it was the end of the season trophy award ceremony banquet. And if you can imagine, it was kind of like a scene out of the movie Patton. Our coach came out. Coach Eric was out there. I'm sure he was chewing gum or something. Hitches up those pants. Gentlemen, and I can call you that, because you started as boys, and now you are young men. Oh, are you kidding me? For a 12-year-old to hear that you started the season as a boy, but now you're a man? Oh, the speech continued. The team did great. You fought together, fought hard. Teamwork, teamwork, teamwork. But you know that there is only one trophy that is reserved for our most valuable player. And he looked right at me and he said, Evan, come up here. best day of my life. Walked up there. He handed me the most valuable trophy. I know. Hold your applause to the end. I'd already worked out the speech in my mind, all these things. But this really was the pinnacle for me. I loved baseball. I'd played it all my life, and here it was. And I was so excited. It really was probably one of my best childhood memories. Fast forward about 6 months later, my dad lost his job, and we were living in North Carolina. Had to come back. We moved back to Atlanta. I moved back to a very unfamiliar place and moved back into a place where I didn't know anybody. And that did not stop me from assuming that I would be winning the Most Valuable Player Award in 1987, because that's what Gary did. And so here I was in this new environment, in this new school, and we were having a game of baseball. And they were picking teams. And of course, being the new kid, I'm standing there wondering if I'm going to be picked. And there is another kid, a much larger kid, who is standing to my right. And we're the last two to be picked. And they kind of look it around. I said, well, what position do you play? And I said, well, I'm a catcher. I won the 1986 Most Valuable Player Award at Carolina Power and Light. You probably heard about it, but the gentleman to my right, his name was Terry. And the reason I remember that, I'll tell you in a second. So they said, okay, and they pointed at me and said, we'll take you. So I started to walk out of the field, and I sheepishly turn around and I look at Terry, and I just kind of did, you know, one of those. Not a great move. Because the next moment, I feel this pain and thud in the back of my head, and I drop to the ground like a sack of potatoes. And I can't tell you what Terry said, because it's not appropriate for this room. But I can tell you the spirit behind what he said. You're not the most valuable player. You're not going to make it in this league. You don't have what it takes. And in that moment, I think this is the first time that I felt something rise up inside of me. Something that would start here, but would follow me for the rest of my life. This anxiety that led ultimately to this fear. Now, in that moment, I wouldn't necessarily have said fear of my physical surroundings, although that was a part of it. Terry was very big. Matter of fact, the reason I remember his name was Terry was because my mom called him Terry the Terrible at that point, which 12-year-old was like, yeah, Terry the Terrible, you know. Can I have another ice pack? But fear. And this would not be the last experience that I would have. This would not be the last moment where an experience would lead to anxiety, which would ultimately lead to fear. For me, fear became a crippling emotion. Fear became my kryptonite. In fact, I think for today's purposes, I would say that fear is the kryptonite that keeps us from being the heroes that we're called to be. Fear is the kryptonite that keeps us from being the heroes that we're called to be. And I know what you're thinking. I wasn't called to be a hero. And I wouldn't have said that either. But we all grew up having a hero. We all had someone we could look at and say, that's my hero. I want to be like her, or I want to be like him when I grow up. Because there's something in us that doesn't want to be average. It doesn't want us to be ordinary. We want something more. And the world needs people who want to do something more. Today, I basically have two major fears that I still wrestle with: public speaking and flying, which is ironic because I was rehearsing this talk on Wednesday, flying back from Minnesota. That's true. Now, a couple things you need to know about that. If you are not afraid to fly, I think you're just not paying attention. Fear of flying is very real for a lot of people. It is one of the things that absolutely has the power to cripple me. It's one of the, when someone drops a water bottle in the aisle and it's like, oh my gosh, we lost an engine. It's like, no, it's just a water bottle. You're going to be okay. But it really is. It's one of those crippling things. And all of us don't have to look too far to find something to fear. If you go on the internet or spend any time on social media, you will find something called clickbait. Does everyone know what clickbait is? Okay, well, I'll explain. Clickbait are these headlines that pop up in your news feed or in your Facebook feed, and these headlines are preying upon your fears, fear of whatever, fear of missing out. And the headline usually says something like this, something that would go, all she did was drag her plate across the pool. What happened next will blow your mind. So you click on it, and you never find out what happened next. You end up with a juicer that you never use. And that is clickbait. And it's usually preying on some sort of fear we have. But for many of us, fear is more personal. Perhaps it was a school that you didn't get into, and all of a sudden, your plans had been changed for you. And things looked uncertain, and what you wanted to do was no longer possible. For others, it's a relationship that you're in and you were so certain that they were the one. But when he left or when she left, the other shoe dropped. And anxiety led to fear about stepping into another relationship. Maybe in your office, you hear whispers of a reorganization. And you start to ask the question, well, where is that going to leave me? All of us have gotten that phone call after midnight and immediately that pit in your stomach feeling of, uh-oh. And for some of us, someone hurt us. And fear is what lies in the wake. Now, let me say this before we get too much further. Fear is a really big idea. Nothing that I can say in the next 25 minutes is a silver bullet. My hope is that if you are here today and this is something that you have wrestled with, my hope is perhaps today doesn't represent a finishing line, but maybe a starting block. Because it's a big deal. And while fear is common, and all of us have experienced fear, it doesn't have to cripple us. While fear is common, it's often a byproduct of a past experience. But fear, I believe, is actually rooted in something less obvious. We're gonna look at a story today that is in the Bible. And for many people, it would be a familiar story. And for some of you that have not heard the actual story, some of the elements of the story will be familiar. This story is found in the book of Matthew. Matthew was one of the followers of Jesus, and he recorded the things that happened as they traveled together. But before I tell you this story, I need to tell you two things first. The first is if you would not consider yourself a God person or a person of faith or a Jesus follower, I think this story might frustrate you and might frustrate you for two reasons. The first is the very physics of this story. We're gonna see something in the story and it might cause you to ask the question, how could that happen? How could that possibly happen? I would ask you perhaps just to suspend the question of how could that happen and ask the question, what can we learn from this? The second thing that may frustrate you, for Christians, this is going to be a reminder, a simple reminder of something. But if you're not a follower of Jesus, you may think that I have an agenda this morning. And I do, but I just don't want that to frustrate you. So the story picks up. As we said, in the narrative of Matthew had recorded these events. And it happens immediately after this incredible miracle. Jesus had fed 5,000 people by multiplying five loaves of bread and a couple of fish. And they had just experienced this. And in that moment, at the end of that story, Jesus immediately tells his disciples to go on ahead of him. He puts them in a boat, pushes them off into the Sea of Galilee so he can dismiss the crowd and spend some time alone. Now, the Sea of Galilee is a—it's a sea, it's a lake. Those are kind of interchangeable terms. It looks very placid right here. Do you see the boat there? That's not the boat that they were on, but it was a boat like that. But the sea could often be really, really serene. It's hard to tell, but up towards the top of this picture, you'll see some plateaus, and these plateaus would create the perfect environment for sudden and violent storms. And so this is where we find our disciples, Jesus' disciples, our friends. This is where the story picks up in Matthew 14, 24. The boat was already a considerable distance from the land. It was buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Some translations say the wind was torturing the boat. We know in this moment they're about 3 to 4 miles from where they began. So they have been at this for about 9 hours. They should have been a lot further than where they were at this point. So they are struggling and they are out in the middle in the waves, crashing in the rain, it's falling, the wind is blowing. But many of these men were fishermen. So this is not necessarily an unusual place for them to be. But here they found themselves stuck, certain of where they were going, certain of who sent them, but now stuck in the middle and wondering what's next. And I believe this is where fear begins to set in. And I believe this is where their story intersects with our story. Because I believe that our fears are rooted in our inability to predict our future. Our fears are rooted in our inability to know for certain where we're going next. And this would have been true for the disciples. They knew where they're going. Not only did they know where they're going, they were armed with this experience that Jesus had just fed the 5,000. So they had moved out in that. But now they found themselves stuck when it got cloudy. I love this part of the next story. Shortly before dawn. It's always darkest before dawn, but shortly before dawn, and this may be where you are tempted to check out, but stick with me. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. And the question is, how in the world would he walk on the lake? How did he feed 5,000? He could do miracles. He could have done anything in this moment. He could have calmed the storm. He could have kept the storm from coming at all. But for some reason, Jesus chose to illustrate a point by walking out to his disciples on the lake. And I love this. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, sure, they were surprised, but they had a different emotion. They were terrified. It's a ghost, they said. And they cried out in fear. All of them cried out in fear. See, something happened in that interchange from just being uncertain about where they're going. Now there is a ghost in front of them. That is not a very usual thing for a fisherman to see. And so they find themselves in a storm faced with imminent threat. And while our fears are rooted in our inability to predict our future, when our future goes from cloudy to compromised, we find that our fears are accelerated by our inability to protect our future. Rooted in an inability to predict, but when it becomes compromised, we realize we can't even protect our future. Fear is accelerated. I love this part of the story because it's, again, we're going to see another word, but Jesus immediately said to them. Now, Jesus could have said anything in this moment, but what he chose to say, I think he says to me, and I think potentially he says to you. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." Take courage. He could have said anything. He could have said, "Come on, guys, be brave. Man up. Get over it. It's just a little storm." But instead of that, he offered something else. "Take courage from me. It is I. Guys, you know me. We have traveled together. You have seen miracles. We just fed 5,000 people. You know me, trust me. In fact, I wonder if he would have said, this isn't the first time that we've been in a boat together in a storm on a sea. In fact, Matthew recorded 6 chapters earlier a similar event when they're in a boat, in a storm, on the sea, and Jesus calmed the storm then. It is I, you know me. You do not have to be afraid. And then there's this moment in the story. I suspect you have felt it before when you're watching a movie and you see the unlikely hero who is starting to come alive a little bit and they're getting ready to do something heroic. One of the 12 rises up. So imagine he put his foot right on the bow of the boat in response to Jesus and says, Lord, if it is you, if it's you who you say you are, Peter, our hero replied, tell me to come to you on the water. Now this is crazy because the water is not calm. The water is still raging. But Peter decided to take Jesus up on the offer. He is taking courage. He is trusting that it is him. And he is choosing to let Jesus quiet his fears. And I love what Jesus does here. He just says, come. Come on. And now Peter, standing on the edge of the boat, in this moment, Peter comes face to face with a decision that I have to continually make, potentially you as well. He has a decision, and the decision is simply this. Would he allow the fear of stepping out lead to missing out? Would he allow his fear of stepping out of the boat lead to missing out from something that Jesus had for him? See, something in Peter's statement, Lord, if it is you, tell me to come to you and I will come. Something in that statement, Peter says, I know that if you call me, it's going to be extraordinary. If you call me, I'm going to experience something no one else will ever experience. If you call me, I will come. And with that, the water still raging, Peter stepped out of the boat and he's walking on water. Can you imagine the emotion he was feeling right now? I'm the MVP of the disciples. Like, I get the trophy. Walked on the water and came towards Jesus. I don't know what the other disciples were doing at that point, but they had to have marveled at what was happening. So as the waves are still moving around and he's walking towards Jesus, we're not exactly sure how this works, but the text says, but when he, Peter, saw the wind, he was afraid. I don't know if he saw the wind or the rain and the wind. I don't know if it was the waves smacking up against him. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. When he took his eyes off the one he trusted, he became afraid. And beginning to sink. Have you ever felt that way? Out in the middle, storm comes up, and you begin to sink. And everything you thought was going to happen has changed. Your ability to predict and protect is shown to be a fraud. And here you are. And here's where we find Peter sinking. Now, in this moment, I think Peter had 3 options. I think Peter's first option was simply to hold his breath. Not a great one. Peter's second option was to turn back to his friends and say, will you throw me a lifeline? But I love what Peter, our hero, does in this moment. He does the exact same thing that he did when he stepped out of the boat. Beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. He took his eyes off the wind, put him back on the object of his trust, and he said, Lord, save me. I know it is you. I trust you. I will not be afraid. Save me. And with that, Jesus, with all the compassion and all the things that would come with knowing someone so intimately, simply looked at him and said, Save yourself, Peter. This was your idea. I'd like to close this in prayer. Of course not. In fact, this is the thing I love about this passage. The word that pops up is immediately. 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 Jesus reached out his hand and he caught him. Love that. The storm is still going on. The waves are going and Jesus grabs him and he pulls him up. And now I think they are face to face and they're sitting there on the waves, standing on the waves. And I really believe in this moment that Jesus, in all compassion, with all empathy, says these next words. He says, "You little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" I don't think Jesus was giving him a speech. I don't think Jesus was trying to make him feel guilty. I think Jesus in that moment was saying, "Why did you doubt? You were here. You were here with me on the waves. You experienced something extraordinary, something that the other 11 will never get to do. You did it. You have what it takes." And with that, Peter and Jesus got back into the boat and the waves and winds subsided. Now, I don't know what motivated Peter. I don't know if he has some sort of hero gene. I suspect that what motivated Peter is he wanted more than just being an average fisherman. And if you can imagine this happening today, this would be on your newsfeed. This would become clickbait. You would want to click this. Man walks on water with a ghost. Find out how he did it. You would click. And I think if the reporters were to come and ask Peter and say, "Peter, tell us about that day," I think Peter would say, "Well, my friends, the sea was angry that day, and we were afraid. We were all afraid." Yeah, but Peter, you got out of the boat. Why? I got out of the boat because Jesus said, "Take courage." Jesus didn't say, "Man up." Jesus didn't say, "Be brave." Jesus said, "I offer you courage. Take it." And then Jesus said, "It is I." And I got to tell you guys, I've traveled with Jesus. I've spent the last 3 years with Jesus. I saw him feed 5,000 people. And when he said, "It is I said, "Yes, you know what? I know you. I know the power you have. I know what you can do. And I know what you offer is extraordinary. So I trusted him." So I'd say, take courage and trust Jesus. And then lastly, I think I would tell everybody, if you're on the edge of a dream, the edge of a decision, on the edge of a phone call, the edge of repairing a relationship, don't let your fear of stepping out lead to missing out. What's on the other side of my fear and what's on the other side of your fear is something extraordinary that is offered to us. And as reporters do, I think the reporters at that point would be like, yeah, but wait. You began to sink. You took your eyes off and you began to sink. Tell us about that. And I think Peter would say, "I did. And you know what? I'll do it again when I'm tempted to fear. But here is what I know. Who you trust is greater than what you fear." When I had the ability to take my eyes off the wind, the thing that I feared, and put it back on the object, the focus of my trust, I could do that. I could take courage. I could trust it because I knew that the fear of stepping out could eclipse my fear of missing out. About 22 years ago, I was a junior at the University of Georgia, and I had lived with a growing fear for, as I said, most of that time in between there. And if you've ever carried emotion around with you, sometimes an emotion becomes very, very comfortable, but it can also be very exhausting. So the spring of my junior year, I found my place exhausted, tired of masking my fear, tired of running from my fear, but not knowing what to do with it. I had a friend of mine who is one of my heroes, Pat Pickren, And Pat and I were at Georgia together. And Pat was one of those guys that was just uber confident, but uber quiet confident. You never would have known. He was not loud or boisterous. He just was assured. And I called Pat one day and I said, "Pat, what is it about you that allows you to live a fear-free life?" He said, "Do you really want to know?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, let me take you to lunch." And that lunch became one of many, many lunches over many, many years. But at that lunch, he said to me, "I don't operate life without fear, but I take courage from Jesus by trusting in Jesus." And I thought in that moment, I can do that. And I did. And I never feared again. Absolutely untrue. I thought it can't be that simple. And he says, "It's not that simple. It will take you a lifetime." He said, "But trusting in Jesus will allow you to operate life with your fears quieted." So I began pursuing those three things: taking courage, trusting Jesus, and not letting my fear of stepping out lead to missing out. Learning who Jesus was, trying to figure out who this man was. I don't know where this message lands with you today. I don't know really, honestly, where the message lands with me today. I am wrestling with this every day of my life. But here's what I do know. I have experienced extraordinary on the other side of my fear more often than I have experienced regret not getting out of the boat. So today, if you're here and you are gripped with fear, my prayer for you is that you could just take courage, that you could come to a place where you think, "You know what? I can't conquer my fear on my own. Maybe I can take courage from someone greater than me." Perhaps you've never trusted Jesus, or that's a foreign concept, or that's just a weird thing. It's like, trust Jesus with what? My hope is that you would take a step, that you would be curious. And lastly, if you are in that spot where you're getting ready for something big, my prayer is you will step out knowing that Jesus is with you. We're going to close with a song today. I think music is fantastic. I love music. I think music has a way of connecting truth to our hearts. This particular song is a song that sits on my playlist, particularly when I'm flying. It is a song that brings strength because of what the song is about. Some lyrics in this song that I'd love for you to pay attention to. Peace, peace, bring it all to peace. The storm surrounding me, let it break at your name. Still call the sea to still. Jesus, you make the darkness tremble. Jesus, you silence fear. We pray for us. Heavenly Father, thank you for this story that we find in the Gospel of Matthew. It is good news for me. And Father, I am so grateful for your son, Jesus. And Father, I'm so incredibly grateful for my friend, Pat, who introduced me to this idea of trusting him, entering into a relationship, who opened my eyes to the power that a relationship with your son offers. Father, wherever this message lands today, I pray that you would do what you do best, which is draw near to those who draw near to you. Whatever that looks like, if it's a step of curiosity, if it's a step out of the boat, Father, would you draw near to us? And Father, I am so thankful for what Jesus has done in my life. It's his matchless, powerful, darkness beating up name, we pray. Amen.
Bring it all to peace. The storm surrounding me, let it break. At your name, still. Call the sea to still. The rage in me to still. Every way. At your name, Jesus, Jesus. All these lungs to sing once again. I will praise Jesus, Jesus. You make the darkness tremble. Jesus, Jesus. You silence fear. Jesus, Jesus. You make the darkness tremble. Jesus, Jesus. You